You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. In this week's episode, continuing our month of shows about anthologies and collectives, we have a trio of interviews recorded at two recent comic book conventions in London. Firstly, recorded last weekend at Kapow in the Islington Design Centre, I'm talking to editor Alan Cowsill and publisher Tim Pilcher from the Comic Book Alliance about their anthology Spirit of Hope that they're bringing out to help raise funds to support the people of Japan after the recent tsunami disaster. After that, I'll be chatting to Joel Meadows, editor of Tripwire magazine, about the new digital incarnation of his periodical, which is about comics and pop culture. And then finally, in an interview recorded last month at the London Comic and Small Press Expo at Goldsmiths College, Dickon Harris is talking to Shaky Kane about his career, which has ranged from small pieces in a variety of anthologies, such as 2000 AD Escape and Revolver, to his new serialized graphic novel, The Bulletproof Coffin, written by David Hine, who also has a Sneeze and You'll Miss It cameo in the interview. Before all that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Tim Pilcher and Alan Cowsill. You guys are launching a new anthology to help Japan in the wake of the terrible disaster they've had there recently. Could you talk a little bit about how you first conceived the project and how you started approaching contributors?
Well, it was an interesting thing. The morning that it broke on the news, I emailed one of our co-founders, GM Jordan, and we kind of sat and ruminated on this thing, and we just thought, you know, we and then almost simultaneously, we both emailed each other at the same time, said, we've really got to do something about this. And we just felt, you know, the best thing we could do is to get comic creators together to create an anthology and to raise some money. And so the next thing was to find someone that was insane enough to take on actually editing and coordinating this. And very fortunately, Alan sort of stepped up to the plate and kind of done just a fantastic, sterling job in putting this thing together.
Yeah, well, originally it was only going to be a quick 52-page comic. And overnight it turned into an 120-page graphic novel.
Wow.
That's amazing. The very next day, actually, my emails didn't stop pinging with people coming in from not just England, but all over the world. We've had at least three or four Japanese artists come up with fantastic work. It's amazing. I mean, it makes me cry at the computer some bit. You know, it's the selection's so beautiful that's in there. There's funny stories, there's tragic stories. We've got people like Liam Sharp, Simon Colby, Peter Hogan, some great names and artists all contributing work. It's fantastic. And I've got two covers from Mike Allred and
James Hodgkins.
Yeah. One for the bookshops, one for the comic shops, hopefully. And it's just going to be an amazing book.
I mean, yours is a fairly new organisation. You've been around about a year now, I think.
It's about a year and a half, 18 months, yeah. And it's just been going from strength to strength, basically. The problem has been when we first started out was we were a very well-meaning organisation with not a lot of power, really. Yeah. But we've been slowly building up what we can do. And we did a big charity auction, online auction on eBay at the end of last year. And we had some amazing prizes, like a personalised caricature by Frank Quietly. We managed to get one bidder into an episode of Batman Inc. number 4, which has just come out, yeah, which is fantastic. And he bid for that. So we've had really brilliant support from everybody right across the industry. And that's meant that we've got a lot of money now that we can actually start doing some real projects. We've got a lot of plans over the next 18 months, really, which involve retailers and educational side of things. So big plans ahead. But this is the Spirit of Hope is the first of hopefully several projects that will really help other people. I think that's the nice thing about this. And what we've realised is, talking to some of the Japanese creators, is it's that feeling that they're not alone. You know, that there are sort of fellow creators out there in the world who are supporting them in the way that the language that everyone speaks. And there's this universal language of comics, which everyone understands and speaks. And so that's had a really kind of emotive effect, which has been really fantastic.
Has moving into publishing been a particular challenge? Or because you have all these links with the comic book industry already, it means that you've got hundreds of people you can actually ask for advice?
Well, I think for us, I don't know if we would necessarily be moving wholesale into publishing. I think we're quite wary of not. But we felt that rather than doing another online auction, because there were several of those that had already been set up, we actually wanted to do something that had more personal resonance and heart. And the good thing about the fact that we managed to get this together in about 2.5 weeks was that it has that immediacy. It has that real gut visceral effect of what people were really thinking. I think if we'd left this how sometimes it takes to do a graphic novel over 2 months or something, we wouldn't have had that same sort of powerful effect that comes across, you know. And it really has affected a lot of people, you know, on an emotional level. So that has made a difference to, I think, the material. So for us, I don't think this is more of a one-off. I don't think we would be going in and doing a wholesale publishing program, but we would be looking at maybe the odd occasional special. A bit like the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund do. They'll have little fundraising one-off specials. So I think that's the way we'd go, rather than, you know, publishing a regular comic, per se.
I mean, that's going back to the personal nature of the stories. Some of the Japanese stories that have come over, they're from people who are actually part of what had happened. And just to get sort of their view of events is really touching, and so it's fantastic. So it should be a great book. It's due out end of May, early June.
As the editor, when you're making an anthology, you obviously have to make decisions about what order to put the stories in so that there are interesting juxtapositions. In terms of collaborators, I guess you've got who responded positively to the email, so it's not as if you actively curated a list of people. But has it been quite an easy process finding stories that work well together?
It's been amazingly easy, far easier than I thought. But I think it's partly because of what Tim said, that it's impacted people on such an emotional level. So most of the strips are almost instinctive. They're like the first reactions of people, whether it's in England or Japan, to what's gone on. And what's fascinating is all the stories are different, but there are certain images and themes that are coming through them, like paper cranes and, you know, other elements of Japanese culture that keep reappearing, but not in a overly familiar way, just in a way that as an anthology gives you a nice little theme going through it that works really well, I think. And there's going to be a nice few strips to make people laugh along the way when they're crying at the other strips. So it's a really touching anthology, to better look.
Well, I think it's really interesting just to start off with that you've got two different covers, one that appeals to the more traditional comic book buyer and one that has more of a sort of aesthetic bookshop look to it. Was that something that you thought of off the bat, or was it after Mike Aldred approached you, you thought, actually, maybe we can do it for these two different markets?
I think that was just a natural evolution, really. The one we've chosen for the book trade, which is by James Hodgkins, that was one of the very first pieces that came in. He really turned that around incredibly quickly. And it was just a really beautiful piece. It's a slightly abstract piece of a wave and this hopeful flower. And that has just really hit a resonance with a lot of people. They really love it. We're thinking about doing that as a limited print as well. And it just seemed very right. And then we got Michael Allred's piece, and that's really lovely as well. It's a beautiful superhero, sort of talking about hope, you know, and he's got the eight ball saying, looking good. And that just seemed to be more of a natural fit for the comic book stores, per se. So I think, you know, it was a natural evolution that happened. So it was just, you know, purely serendipity. But, I mean, we've had interest from Waterstones, who said they're keen to look at it and probably stock that. And it's going to be distributed by Diamond as well. So, in all good comic shops and bookstores. So it's going to be $14.99. And the all the profit will be going over to Second Harvest, who are a long-term support charity in Japan, and also to a New Zealand disaster relief fund as well.
We have had some stories come in from New Zealand as well, so it's not just Japan. We're covering a few of the earthquakes that happened.
And I guess New Zealand is close enough that they've still had physical effects from the tsunami themselves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, we have a few of the actors. Old editor, I know, Kevin Ridout, who lived over there, who sort of knows a lot of the New Zealand creators, and they're as touched as anyone else. So
We're at Kapow, and I guess the people that designed the table layout here have kind of grouped educational comic book stores together, because you're next to Cartoon Classroom, who are next to a new charity called Upside Comics. In this kind of environment, do you find that actually you do get a lot of positive interaction with people attending the con who want to find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, I think the reaction has been incredibly positive. I mean, I think we've seen a very big new audience come in to this show, who probably have been aware of comics, or, you know, maybe they pick up the odd graphic novel but don't know that much. And so there's an eagerness to learn and to find out more. And so for us, that's perfect. That's exactly what we're here to do, is to help sort of teach them, guide people, and get them involved. You know, we're looking for sort of volunteers to get involved and help out and support the British comic industry and help it grow and evolve and adapt and just get bigger. So, yes, we're all for more and more people coming by the stand. And, yeah, it's been great. Very positive.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Cheers.
For more info about Spirit of Hope and the work of the Comic Book Alliance, please check out their website, www.comicbookalliance.co.uk. Next, here's my interview with Joel Meadows about the relaunch of Tripwire as an online magazine.
I'm talking to Joel Meadows at Kapow. You've been editing Tripwire for many years now, and recently you started doing it as sort of seasonal specials. But you emailed me to say that it's now going to become a PDF digital version?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we've been doing Tripwire for 19 years now, and we've been looking at ways of making it more frequent. And we have been doing the one-off specials and the annuals to keep our name out there, but it seemed like the digital format was a good way to increase sort of the brand awareness of Tripwire and to put ourselves out more frequently. And it seemed like everything was in place, the tools were in place to be able to put something out which was of the same quality and the same standard as the print version, but just for, you know, for the iPads. And we're also going to be doing it for the Nook and for the Kindle. We've been talking about it for the last 12 months, but now everything seems to be in place where it seems a lot more practical and just a better way to do things.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you're doing it for the Kindle, because there seems to be a real lack of things that you can download for that. But then, of course, with different devices, the Kindle, for example, is black and white,
yes,
relatively low res. The iPad is high res and colour.
Yes.
How difficult is it formatting the pages so that it'll appear in a format that looks well on whatever e-reader you have?
Well, we're trying to tailor it. I mean, it has been a little bit tricky, but we're hoping... I mean, we're in the final development stages of the other versions. I mean, at the moment, we've just really got iPad and PDF, but the Nook and the Kindle ones will come up. But we're going to try and play to their strengths for each format. So it is a challenge, but it's one that we are, you know, prepared to have a go at, because there are so many different formats. And, you know, the Kindle is a nice device, and you see a lot of people read them using their Kindles on the tube and on the train. So we would be foolish to cut out that sector. But you know, we're currently finalizing the other formats at the moment, but we feel confident that we can do it justice, that we can make it as good as experience as, you know, your iPad version or our print version. You know, we want to try and replicate the same experience just on a different platform.
With the iPad version, presumably it's very tempting to put lots of multimedia into it, you know, videos you can play and whatnot. But that obviously makes it far more complicated and far more time-consuming. Are you doing an element of that? And is it hard to balance that with keeping a decent amount of print in the magazine?
Well, we are actually going to be having an interactive element. So, for example, if we review a graphic novel, people will be able to click right through to order it. And also there will be kind of video content and audio content. But we are keen to balance that, because you know, the bells and whistles are good and they're important, but, you know, content is king, and we want to make sure that there is enough quality content for people to consume, basically. So we are very aware of that, but but one of the advantages of doing it interactively or doing it digitally is that you're able to have, you know, stuff like that in there, and it would be foolish not to use that to our strengths.
So what have we got coming up in future digital editions?
Well, I mean, the first one that just launched, which was available from a week ago, has a Thor movie cover, a feature on the genesis of the film, a small sort of a Q&A sidebar with Matt Fraction talking about, you know, writing Thor. And then we've also got a source code feature, interviews with Duncan Jones, with the screenwriter, and with Jake Gyllenhaal talking about the movie. And there's a review of the film. There's a piece on pre-code horror artist L.B. Cole, who's been long forgotten, but re-evaluated and rediscovered thanks to the Gerber photo guides and the internet. We've got a piece on Boom's Hellraiser. That's just the first issue. We've got some Stripwire material with Roger Langridge and Fred the Clowns, and a couple of pieces by a guy called Roman Muradov, who's a very talented artist out of San Francisco, who's very good. So that's the first edition. The second issue, which will be available to download from June, will have an X-Men First Class cover. It'll have interviews with Mike Carey, Kieran Gillen, looking at the current continuity in the X-Men book, and also looking at the history of the movie, and probably reviewing the movie as well. We're going to probably have something on 2000 AD's US Slain edition, because they've done a hardcover of The Horned God. So we're going to do a piece on that. Thing on Falling Skies, Steven Spielberg's new TV series, interview with Mark Verheiden about that. And whatever else sort of comes our way. I mean, the beauty of the digital and the increased format is that we can slot a lot more stuff in there. And they will complement the print version. I mean, in July there will be issue 55, because we've stopped calling them annuals now, which will have a brand new Elric painted cover by an illustrator called David Michael Beck, because it's 50 years of Elric this year. So there'll be a Michael Moorcock interview, a piece about Boom's new Elric series. There'll be a Christopher Fowler interview talking about his career. And he's also doing a Brian DeMay graphic novel. We'll be covering that. Jason Aaron on Scalped, 50 years of Fantastic Four. So the nice thing is that each format feeds back into itself. So that'll be June. August is still TBA at the moment, but we'll probably do, it might be another summer movie, or it might be, maybe it'll be a super, probably have some Super 8 content in that issue, because that looks very interesting. And we might do something about Walking Dead season 2. So, you know, just we'll roll stuff in. So there'll be novelists, there'll be TV coverage, there'll be animation. There'll be film, obviously. There'll obviously be comics. We'll never ignore the medium that is at its centre. So that even though we are very kind of mainstream in our outlook, you know, we would never ditch comics, because comics is at its heart. You know, the heart and soul of the magazine has always been about comics. So that even if it's film, even if our cover is film, you know, the heart of it is still very much about comics.
Yeah. And I guess you're at Kapow today for the same reason that I am, that these conventions are a real kind of congregation of various creators in one place, so it makes it, you know, access quite easy. But it, at the same time, it then gives you a travel itinerary as an editor that you have to travel in order to find people. I mean, having done this for quite a few years, is this a process that has become second nature to you? And how much does going to a place end up leading to the content of future issues, where you wouldn't expect to get an interview, and all of a sudden it happens, and so it means actually you can then maybe work a feature around an interview that you've got?
Yeah, well, it does depend. I mean, obviously I'm lucky because I'm based in London, so travel is half an hour for me on this particular show. But for example, when I went to WonderCon in San Francisco, you do pick up stuff from people. Again, Mark, I bumped into Mark Verheiden, and we'd always wanted something on Falling Skies. I've met him two or three times, but he said, you know, drop me a line and we'll get something arranged. So shows are extremely good. I mean, I'm in a slightly weird position because, as well as doing the magazine, I've also started to dabble in photography. So if I go out of the country, or even if I go somewhere like Bristol, I will end up stopping off at places to take photographs. And so what becomes the journey sometimes becomes not necessarily more important, but almost as important as the place that I get to. But no, I do encounter people, and as you say, sometimes things do come. I mean, on the converse side, sometimes you plan for stuff and then interviews fall through and they don't happen, and then you have to sort of rethink things. But, you know, in the days of the net, and also because we have quite a deep library and quite a few other contacts, we can put stuff together which is a feature rather than an interview, which gives things a historical context. So basically we're able to turn that to our advantage. So sometimes it's frustrating when you don't get an interview that you've been sort of hoping for, but there are always ways of presenting things a slightly different way, which is just as interesting and just as valid. But, you know, just putting things in a more contextual way. Mm. So shows are, they do feed, you know, they feed feature ideas. Just from a promotional perspective, I've been obviously giving out flyers to promote the digital version. And just to sort of show your face to say, look, you know, I'm here, still here, I'm still, you know, doing stuff. It's still important that, you know, for companies, for publishers and for creators, you still need to talk to us. You need to tell us what you're doing, what you've got coming up, what you're publishing. For creators, you know, what you're working, what you're writing, what you're drawing. So it is a good influx. And also, a lot of the time, we do work in isolation, you know, putting stuff together, and it's nice to get feedback from people to go there. They go, oh, I really enjoyed the last issue. Or, you know, like I was at San Francisco, I saw Glenn David Gold, who I interviewed for the last print issue of the magazine. He said he really enjoyed it. So it's nice to, and it, you build up a rapport, you build up an ongoing relationship with people so that when they work on, when they got their next project, you can go, you know, what are you working? They go, oh, I'm working on this and we'd like to talk to you about it. Because, you know, we you know, things went very well last time. We felt like you did us proud, you know, you gave us some nice coverage, you know, so it's, shows are essential, possibly more so than ever before. I mean, you do lose work days if you're out of the country, as you know, or even if you're out of home, you do lose a few days, which you have to try and pick up, or you have to work on the road, which is rather frustrating sometimes. But you have to evolve, you have to adapt, and you just have to, you know, if something needs to be delivered, you just have to go and write it or record it or edit it. You just have to get on with it.
Cool. Thank you very much.
For more info and to download the new digital version of Tripwire, please visit their website www.tripwire-magazine.com. Finally, here's Dick and Harris's interview with Shaky Kane about illustrating the new comic Bulletproof Coffin, a love letter to EC Comics and Atom Age pop culture by Kane and writer David Hine.
Hi, this is Dick and Harris. I'm sitting today at the Small Press Expo in Goldsmith University. I'm sitting down today with Small Press creator and mainstream comic creator, if I can say that, Shaky Kane, who's worked with some of the comic greats, including David Hine and Mark Miller, as well as working for 2000 AD for a collection of titles, and more recently on the Bulletproof Coffin, as well as his own self-published work, Monster Truck. Is that a pretty good summary? What am I doing, Shaky?
That sort of sums it up accurately enough. You know, and it sounds quite an itinerary, doesn't it, when you say it like that?
Well, it's a full resume, I've only picked up a couple of highlights.
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting, because I read some of your earlier work in the 2000 AD, and obviously, I think there's been a slight change in how you draw the figures, in terms of the sort of quite in-your-face, slightly more stylized figures.
That's accurate. In fact, in the time I was away from comics, I spent the time trying to make my work a bit more sort of reader friendly. I was relying too heavily, I think, on Jack Kirby. I don't know if that made me that popular in Britain, you know.
That makes sense, actually, thinking back at some of the pictures, because you've got this very blocky feel to it, which sort of makes sense with Kirby, and as well as the use of everything. It's on all the time, if that makes sense.
That's right, yeah. I tried to bring a certain dynamic to the page, but sometimes maybe my drafting skills couldn't fulfill what I was trying to do, you know. But I've been away for a while, and I've come back, and I've been getting quite a good response, you know, for what I've been doing now.
Talk about some of your favourite titles when you were working in 2008. What were the sort of your favourite titles to work on then?
The favourite title would have been the Sogun Warrior, which was the first series, which was co-created with Alan McKenzie, who actually turned out to be a really nice guy. Surprising for 2018.
Well, were they not all nice then on the creators? Well, you're going to watch what you're saying.
I sort of had the idea that they wondered what I was doing there sometimes, particularly higher up in 2018. You know,
okay.
You know, I don't know if I fitted into the sort of Tsar Jazz framework of artists. I don't know what they expected. You know.
Because it's slightly more experimental and what you do on the page rather
it was more to do with drawing comics rather than screen grabs from science fiction movies, which is the way that the comic book art seemed to evolve with 2080.
Okay, that sort of makes sense. The idea of screen grabs and just simply servicing the story. Very filmic, sort of.
That's exactly the direction that the art will move. In fact, that seems to be a direction that comics in general have moved, you know, which is a bit of a... you know, sort of marginalises what I do, but at the same time makes it stand out, so it sort of worked in my favour.
In terms of influences, when do you think that stopped? Who else would you say like did use comics and didn't take that approach? In terms of who are some of the greats who very clearly comics? You mentioned Kirby already.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I mean, did you see this sort of school of thought where comics is becoming its own sort of art form, established medium, and then suddenly there's suddenly a big move to a very effectively moving comics as mini films?
Yeah, it always struck me bizarre to try to take a drawing that was basically composed of outlines and fill it out as if it's 3D. It seemed to work against itself. I'd imagine a lot of the artists are very good at it. Simon Bisley certainly stood out, but some of his imitators, you know, I can't imagine how that pleased when the comic books, you know, right in the front door, you know, the paper they print, I've seen to sap the life out of the artwork, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, sort of become a sort of muddy, I don't know, I can't feel, no names spring to mind, you know,
I can see that in some sense. But now I think it's gone the other way. You have a very clear split between comic artists who are going for that sort of
that is sort of Alex Ross sort of school of you know the missus stood on the washing machine dressed up as a superhero photograph.
That's right, which is
yeah, which is a nice thing to do, I can imagine, you know. To
I think it's a valid point. Yeah. I think that there is a style people recognize. You know, it tends to be. I almost say like you get these diehard fans who follow the titles and that's what they want.
Yeah.
And then it's quite clearly that split. I know I sort of really considered it that way, but small press tends to be quite recognisable for the fact it isn't trying to emulate those films.
I should imagine the money is to be made in this business if you follow the more realistic approach. I can't imagine that you become that popular with the sort of fanboys, as it were, if you are, you know, drawing a more sort of stylized approach.
It's
seen as the art comic, though, isn't it? You know, that's a problem.
But these things go in cycles, though.
You
talk about your recent success. I mean, the Bulletproof Coffin.
Yeah.
That's been incredibly successful.
It has sold out, although that can be slightly deceptive because of the low print run, which is based on the fact that it's got to be ordered 2 months in advance and then actually seeing it, which means the success as far as success critically, but I'm not a successful man as most people would perceive the idea.
But still, it's quite nice to
it's lovely, it's been great, you know, and of course the trade's coming out, you know.
Well, you saw that today, which is...
we've got a sold out table today, haven't we? But this is because all the press it's generated, when people actually saw it, that's the thing that works against the previews method of ordering comics, you know. The guy actually owns the shop has got to order comics that he hasn't seen, you know, before they've been reviewed.
Ah, right. But having a sell-out title must help that kind of side of the business, saying, listen, sold out.
When we go number two, people will be buying it on the
word of mouth.
Of course.
I have to say, this is, I mean, we talked about your style beforehand, how it changed. I thought simplistically I was going to say it's more about sort of production stuff, but you mentioned this is sort of time away from comics.
Yeah.
What were you doing in between? Were you sort of something completely different, or were you just...
Oh. No, I did all different things. You know, I did children's comics, which I sort of moved back to Devon, and I worked for a company who were producing children's comics, you know, like really basic sort of early learning titles. I worked at an animation studio. I worked for King Rollo and... I can't remember the other... King Rollo, and I worked for Honeycomb. But these were always on very short contracts, you know. And I did art, paintings, had exhibitions, punk rock album covers, contributed for both. Yeah, I did anything, as long as it was an art job, you know.
Did working to all those different breeds help develop your style at all? Was it I mean, was it something you like? Did it make you sort of force your style, or did it actually learn? I mean, what did you learn quite a lot from doing this different gig? I mean,
I did. Yeah, yeah. I find that it sort of freed me up a bit, you know, because when you're doing for like comics that are going to. But people are going to cast a critical eye over you. Tend it's you know, it's harder. But when you're drawing kids' comics, you can draw, you know, pretty loopy. You know, right. You know, yeah. It sort of freed me up as an artist. And I find it, you know, quite nice. You know, okay. Of course, you know, a good 10 years pass, and in that time, I've constantly drawn. You know, I feel I can draw pretty much anything. You know.
Anything.
Yeah, anything.
It feels like a panel board challenge.
Yeah, anything.
If anyone can think of anything, Shaky Kane can't draw, you know, please send any messages in.
Oh, you'll be getting the replies though, won't you? To say Judge Dredd.
But I think one thing I really enjoyed, particularly about the Bulletproof Coffin series, was the some of the designs for these and the makeshift history, this sort of false publishing history for Golden Nuggets, which is a. It's a sort of a meta-comics idea that there's comics within comics and these various different non-existent titles. But you must have been a hoot to come up with these various designs. You've got Ramona, the Queen of Stone Age, and you've got the Red Wraith as well. Yeah. So Ramona's basically a homage to Sheena, is that right? And
That sort of genre. I don't
Jungle
know,
Girl. Or,
I don't know a lot about those characters, to be honest, but they just got a feel to them, you know. Queen of Stone Age, of course, the name of a band, Ramona, so Ramones, so I suppose that sort of collided in my head somehow. I thought about just like that, you know. Pow, 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 you know.
And the Red Wraith is great.
Red Wraith's great name, great
feels,
guy.
It feels like a sort of World War II.
That's right, you can imagine flying a plane with
a Zeppelin.
A Zeppelin even, anything. And Coffin Fly, what a great name.
And then you've got the Grateful Dead as well, the Ungrateful Dead.
The Hateful Dead. Another nice one. The Shield of Justice. It's a bit obvious, but it's a nice idea, you know. You know, the dead cop coming back.
Which is the Spectre, isn't it? I mean, that's the...
It's the Spectre. It's Captain America being dredged out of the Hudson or whatever in the Jack Kirby stroke Steranko times, you know. It's got all of that in it, you know. It's stuff that I've always liked, refiltered.
I think what's funny is that because these things have such an energy, like the various characters. Yeah, you feel like they could be expanded into various stories by their own right.
That's right, you could spin out, couldn't you? It's almost like a wish where you think, I wonder what those comics would be like, you know, what they'd really be like. But it's very hard to do that, you know. You sort of slip into that sort of self-parody thing or that sort of, thing that's been the well-worn path of sort of retro-looking comics. So we tried to, in a way, to avoid that and make it part of the general sort of... general story itself, you know. I don't know if they would have been so warmly received if they were standalone retro-looking comics. You know, it fits within this, you know. The style doesn't shift that greatly between the outside and the inside, really. You know, there's sort of a homage there, but I don't look at old comics and unpick the style. I just draw how I feel it looked, you know.
Okay.
I don't sit down with a Kirby comic and I think that's how Kirby draws, you know. I sort of draw, this is the stuff I like drawing, you know.
Obviously Kirby's a clear influence.
This
one was more obvious in your early work. Like, now I notice that when I look at sort of things like the Monster Truck, there's a clearer, I think you've got a clearer...
I'm also Jeff Darrowism creeping in, isn't there? Well, with the actual figure drawn in the lines, you know. Not quite so packed with... And that's another, you know, someone I like. I like... Rip. Do you know Rip, who does the Avatar covers? He's doing Wolverine the Best There Is at the moment for Marvel. He's one of my favourites. Juan Jose Rip, I think he's called.
Juan Jose Rip. Okay, well, that's one for me to check out later.
Yeah, he's influenced me in a way.
Did you find that sort of... Your drawings have tend a bit more spatial, if that makes sense now. Is that...
That's right. I used to do a lot of blocky shading in the very early. So I think it was like lino cuts, like that done by.
That's right.
Yeah, they used to look like a German lino cut artist. You imagine and woodblock stuff.
And now all of a sudden, like this, your comics feel a bit. I think maybe the perspective is perhaps like slightly tighter or things a bit.
I'm drawing the things really, really big, and they're being shrunk down, so they look a lot more delicate than they really are. in issue one, say the tree in that picture was actually drawn to A3 size,
wow,
shrunk down, and then added into the picture using, you know, time-honored computer effects.
Is that true?
Yeah, all the panels are really big.
A3 or so?
The figures themselves I draw big. I can't draw small.
Fair enough.
At the time, I didn't know how to scan in anything bigger than A4, so I used to go to the Xerox Center and get them reduced to A4, simply so I could scan them in to make out the panels. That's absolutely true. I haven't got such a thing as... original pages, because they're original panels.
The actual inking that dictates it in a way, because the type of start inking as well. Because
if
you've got so big, it stops you from wanting to do heavy shading.
Everything's inked with one of these pens, so you can't see it obviously.
What is it?
It's a paper made nylon tip flare, and it's great, you know, you can turn corners with it. It always comes out nice, you know.
Okay, cool. Well, what's your next project then? You've got this laptop.
I've done a special Elephant Man for Richard Starkins, which is out in May, which is a whole issue. Pretty good story he's come up with. It's extreme cosmetic surgery and very pneumatic looking babes, you know. So it sort of fits my. Fits my, I don't know what the word is, my repertoire.
Okay.
It suits my repertoire.
And, fair enough. Bulletproof Coffin, any more? Is that the final, that one? Or is there.
It's the final Bulletproof Coffin as you know it. It's going to continue to be Bulletproof Coffin disinterred, which Dave tells me means dug up again, usually for a second. For pathological reasons, that's what we're doing. Is that the word? What's it called, Dave? Disinterred? Is it disinterred?
It is.
Disinterred, that's the right word.
Okay, presumably that's going to come out in a couple of months.
Oh, that's going to come. No, it takes a while to draw at that scale.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's going to come out in December, the first issue.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
okay.
And because we like to make sure they come out on time. So we got, we're going to make sure I got at least the first four issues drawn before the first one comes out, so we got only got two issues to draw during the part, you know, you do one every 2 months, you know, and don't let the kids down, you know. That's good. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm sure I look forward to that.
Yeah.
I was going to say thanks a lot for the time.
That's okay.
I know you've got to catch on with some sketches for the for people that are hungry customers. But thanks a lot for the time, and look forward to the next issue of Quantum.
Thank you very much. You know, that's good.
The trade paperback collection of Bulletproof Coffin is available at all good bookshops now, with more info at www.imagecomics.com. And Shaky Kane and David Hine will be talking about their work and doing a signing at Orbital Comics near Leicester Square on Saturday the 7th of May from 5 p.m. Before that, there are a variety of comic book events in London that might interest listeners to the show. On April the 17th, the London Zine Symposium takes place at the Rag Factory on Heneaid Street near Brick Lane, which includes workshops, talks, and table guests from around the world. And the festival celebrates zines, small press, comics, radicals, and DIY culture. Exhibitors include 56A Info Shop, Appalling Nonsense, Bear Cave, Girls Who Draw, Hey Monkey Riot, Hoojima Flip, Liz Lunny, Monster Emporium Press, Nobrow Press, Storm in a Teacup, Vampire Sushi Distro, and many more. That's at the Rag Factory on Heneaid Street in East London from 12 noon to 6 p.m. on Sunday, April the 17th. And you can find more info at www.londonzinesymposium.org.uk. The following weekend, there's an event called 25 Years of John Constantine Hellblazer, which is the opening screening and panel discussion at Sci-Fi London, the London International Science Fiction and Fantastic Film Festival. To belatedly celebrate the 25th anniversary of the start of the ongoing Hellblazer comic, I'm talking to a panel of creators of the comic, Jamie Delano, David Lloyd, Andy Diggle and Peter Milligan in an onstage Q&A about their experiences of continuing the adventures of London's downtrodden Magus, who investigates occult disasters and hauntings. The panel is followed by a screening of the movie Constantine, made in 2005, starring Keanu Reeves. And the event starts at 5 p.m. at the Apollo Piccadilly Cinema on Lower Regent Street. More info at www.scifilondon.com/festival. Then, on April the 30th and 1st of May, I've curated a two-day festival of comics at BFI South Bank in their new venue, the Blue Room, on the first floor. The event includes panel discussions, workshops, talks, a film preview, signings and tables where you can meet creators, and guests include Al Davison, Tom Humberston, David Hine, China Mieville, Denise Mina, Ian Edginton, Edward Ross, Paul Cullicutt, Philippa Rice, Alex Milway, Eddie Robson, V.V. Brown, John Spelling, Leo Connor, Zarina Liu, and Matthew Sherritt. That's at the Blue Room, BFI South Bank, on the 30th of April and 1st of May, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. More info at www.londoncomicsfestival.com. There's also a full listing of events at scifilondon.com/festival, as the festival runs from the 23rd of April to the 2nd of May, and also closes with a new superhero film, Super, directed by James Gunn, creator of Slither, and writer of the remake of Dawn of the Dead. Panel Borders was edited and introduced by Alex Fitch, and recorded by Alex Fitch and Dickon Harris. You can download previous episodes of the show and find out more info about today's guests on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. And Panel Borders will be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.